Hello. Okay. Yes. So, I'm going to talk about isolation today, which is probably one of the most overloaded terms in all of computer science and engineering, but we're going to try to be very specific about exactly what I mean by isolation. I work at Fastly. I've been at Fastly for a very long time. If you're interested in large global networks that are doing interesting things, you should definitely come talk to me afterward. You can find me on Twitter, right there. I am more than happy to be argued with and told that I am wrong, so please do that. Okay, isolation. All right, let me start off first by saying this. What I'm going to talk about for the majority of this talk is probably not new to any of you in the audience. Instead, what I'm trying to do is put it in a slightly different lens than you may have thought about it in the past. So what do I mean when I say isolation here? Well, there's a bunch of different ways that we refer to isolation. Not talking about service isolation, not talking about like server isolation or tenant isolation, really. But some of the ways that we are talking about it here is resource isolation, right? Or process isolation. And then more specifically, fault isolation, and specifically software fault isolation. So like really what I'm talking about is all of these things. Right? So this is probably a little bit non-obvious, right? When we talk about like containers and jails and zones, we probably put those in like one particular box. But then you also have like processes over here. They're actually all kind of, in a weird way, the same thing, or attempting to accomplish the same goals, right? Some of them have stricter isolation, some have less strict isolation, and then you have some that are totally different things like sandboxes, right? But really my point in this entire talk is that isolation is about being able to run some code in whatever way without it affecting other running code in unexpected ways. Like every word in there is very intentional, right? Running, like if you have like two processes, they can certainly interact with each other, but if they're truly isolated, they won't be able to interact with each other in ways that you are not expecting, right? So part of that is resource isolation. We'll talk about that more in a little bit and why it's not just about efficient use of hardware. But then the other part of it, to my mind anyway, is something that sounds a lot like FDIR. Now what is FDIR? FDIR stands for Fault Detection, Isolation, and Recovery. So this is actually a concept from control engineering. And is usually referring to monitoring things like thermal signatures of engines and vibrations and oscillations and so on. So it doesn't apply directly, but rather in a metaphorical way, right? I like it because it separates out three important stages in isolation, right? So detection, isolation, and recovery. Detection implies being able to tell when a fault has occurred, when something has gone wrong in a system, right? Which is actually a little less trivial than you might imagine sometimes. Isolation in our world means being able to prove that when a fault does occur, that its blast radius, for lack of a better term, is limited, and we know exactly how much it can affect. Recovery means, in my mind anyway, being able to ensure that the execution of this program can be continued, or rather, not continued, but restarted, right? And that the host environment, the system as a whole, can still continue unabated. And in a computer program, most of what this is actually, in my opinion, comes down to two things, control flow and data flow. When I say control flow, what I'm talking about is the analysis of the set of possible paths that an execution of a program can take, right? Which, for what it's worth, is not always actually decidable, right? If you have, say, like computed go-tos in a C program, you may not actually be able to tell exactly where they go, for instance, but in some programs you certainly can tell. And when I say data flow, what I mean is the analysis of locations that a program can be storing and retrieving data from, right? So if you work out these two things, this is the point that I want to make like throughout most of this talk, if you work out those two problems, you can actually provide isolation in many different forms, right? So let me put this differently. Let's say I have some code and I have some data. And let's say the first function there on the left is executing. Isolation is really about me being able to say that, like, okay, this function can write data into this part of memory, but it can't write to that part, Or this function can call this other function, but it can't call this one, right? So if you can make a system in which you can prove that sort of thing, you can provide most of the forms of isolation that we care about. Fault isolation is really about reducing the set of possible faults to something that is knowable and recoverable. For instance, if certain code should not be able to, be executed, fault isolation is about being able to either prove that it's not possible to execute it at all, like semantically you can't even describe that situation, or that if it is possible, that when it occurs, we can reliably catch it before any harm is done. Okay, that's enough introduction. Let's talk about processes. Okay, so what is a process? Well, what you are looking at here is the first half or so of the kernel's definition of what a process is. This is the struct, task struct inside the kernel, inside the Linux kernel. So one might ask, what even is a process at this point? Because this looks incredibly complicated. But I'm not even going to talk about that. Instead, let's talk about it this way, in an abstract sort of way. So one might think about your operating system, your running computer, in this sort of way. You have your user space, which is really just composed of the memory for each of these individual processes. And then inside the kernel, you have a certain amount of metadata, which is basically what we were just looking at, that is associated with every one of these processes, right? So what's interesting about this is that that metadata is not actually directly accessible to an executing process. From a process's perspective, it really is just memory. It's a block of memory. That's all a process really is inside user space. The process has access to its own memory, but otherwise it can't actually interact directly with anything else without asking the kernel for help anyway, right? And so that simple thing, that's really all it is. That simple thing is really the crux of process-based isolation, right? The fact that you have two things. You have your memory block and you have your syscall interface, and that's all you have. So really what this all comes down to is virtual memory. It's the biggest component of process-based isolation via the MMU, the memory management unit, and the TLB inside each of our computers. This allows us to pretend that each process has its own memory entirely, right? It has its own 64/48-bit space, depending on how you look at it. It allows them to share this memory without actually realizing that they're sharing. So another key part of this is something that probably seems entirely obvious, because really there's no other way to do it in this case. Code and data actually live in the same space inside of a process. Again, this is nothing that should be surprising to anyone here, but I'm trying to put it through a slightly different lens. Code in our process model is actually just data, right? Process-based isolation works because if the only thing that a process has access to is its own memory, and that is also where all the code lives, then we don't really have to care. Then we don't really have to care about control flow, right? We don't have to worry about where that process can jump to, because all it has access to is its own memory. That's an important decision because it ties us so strongly to the safety properties of virtual memory. It's another way of saying this is that we don't really care what happens inside of a process as long as the wall that we've built around it isn't broken, which, as a side note, is also why the Spectre attacks were such a bombshell, right? Because we have this wall that is the entirety of our process isolation, and suddenly, with Spectre attacks, you can read memory across different processes, or at least until some of the things were applied recently. But that's actually That's why it was such an important vulnerability. So the other part, the other thing that processes have is access to an interface with the kernel, syscalls. So syscalls tend to be calls that affect the process itself, so they're affecting that metadata that's associated with the process, or they're allowing communication with other processes in a very defined manner. So, for instance, it's via syscalls that we give processes the ability to interact with things outside of them, right? So if I were to say in this process, mmap this particular file, and kernel just plops it right there into my memory. That's really all it has access to, right? So of course, since all I have is memory, it's just yep, I'll just map this file, boop, right there, great. And then if this other process were to map the same, It just drops it right in the same place, right? And so this, it is via the kernel that processes actually are able to interact with anything at all outside of themselves. Okay, let's talk about containers. Here's something that probably is not surprising to most people in the room. Containers are just processes. That's really all they are. So they are processes with like a couple little things added to them, specifically namespaces, as well as C groups and seccomp, right? And so I will say this, for like further information about this, I am not a container expert. Literally watch any talk by Jesse Frizzelli and you will learn everything you ever wanted to know about containers. So I'm not gonna talk about these much. But what it really comes down to is that one of the most important aspects of containers is this concept of resource isolation, right? So if we go back to our mmap example, we have this particular process which is mmap some data. If this one tries to map that same data, but they have different file system namespaces, it won't work, of course. So this is like the way in which resource isolation is not just about like preventing things from using too much memory or anything. Resource isolation is, in fact, like still a security constraint, right? It's still a way of preventing processes from interacting with each other when you don't want them to. All right, let's talk about, we've talked about processes and containers. Let's talk about a super different one, dynamic libraries, right? So this is essentially DLopen, right? So we're gonna use the linker that's built into our process, and we're going to open a separate library. We're gonna load its code into our existing process, and we're gonna run it. What could possibly go wrong? So interestingly, you might think of loading dynamic libraries in a similar way to the way we were just talking about processes. The extant symbols inside the process form the interface through which the library can get resources, right? So if the library, say, has an undefined symbol, it'll grab that from the rest of the process. On the other hand, if the process wants to grab something from inside the library, it can just do that, right? So in a weird sort of way, it is kind of similar to the like to what we were just discussing. The trouble with this metaphor is that it doesn't work at all. Yes, those interfaces exist and you can use them, but the problem is that those interfaces are actually just convenience, right? Going back to like that process model again, everything inside memory here is really just, it's the Wild West. Like, you load load libraries into a process's memory space, and the issue is that, essentially, the library can access any memory inside the process. The process can access any memory inside the library. The libraries can access memory across each other. It's chaos, right? So there is effectively no isolation when you are loading dynamic libraries like this. So why am I talking about this? If we can make nearly zero safety guarantees with this way of doing things, why does anyone do it? Like, why do we load things in this way? And the answer is that it really comes down to overhead a lot of the time, right? So if you have two separate programs that need to interact with each other, and you put them in separate processes, you might be saying like, all right, I'm gonna send a message to this other process, and then the kernel's like, okay, I will then take that message and I'll queue it up. And then later that process is like, I wanna receive. Okay, here it is. Okay, whereas if you load your two programs into the same address space, what you can do is just call, right? You can just call something inside the other library, right? So a lot of this really comes down to overhead, and the problem is that high-performance systems with many small tenants and strict latency requirements may find that VMs, containers, and even processes can be too heavyweight, right? So this is a problem that we actually face at Fastly, where when people sign up and start using Fastly, they would like to write programs that run at the edge of our network, right? And if I were to spin up a process for every one of the requests that comes into our system, our servers would melt, right? And so instead, we do something slightly different, right? So how do we, like, what are we to do if we have traditional isolation techniques that are too heavyweight, and on the other hand, we have lightweight techniques that are far too dangerous, what can we do? And the answer is higher level isolation, right? One way to address this is, like, if the language that you are using provides a way to do it, you can compile the code such that it is provably safe. So, let's talk about WebAssembly. This is a tiny little WebAssembly program. I will walk through it just briefly here. So at the bottom here, you can see a couple like important lines. This is where it's defining its memory, right? Unlike a normal process, like a WebAssembly program requires you to define an external memory. You say, okay, I have memory, it is one page, and here is some data that I'm gonna put into it, right? So in this case, I'm putting data at offset 16 in the memory, and I'm putting more data at offset 32, right? And that is all the memory that program has access to, right? So up here we define a function, and so it's a stack machine, WebAssembly is. And so what you'll see is I'll put 16 onto the stack. I will then load the value that's at 16, which is that line, which really is just 32. And then I'll call puts using that data, which will then print hello world to the screen. One of the interesting things about this is that unlike in like the normal process space thing where you're loading a library into your existing process, you can't just grab any function, right? Instead, you actually have to explicitly import a function into a WebAssembly program, right? So essentially, there is no way to express calling a function that you haven't explicitly defined or imported. Remember, going back to control flow. So one of the interesting things about WebAssembly is that unlike a normal process, which is just memory, a WebAssembly program looks more like this. Your code is actually entirely separate from your memory. Right, your linear memory is one thing, but your code is entire, like there's no way to say take an address to a particular like piece of code. There's no way to get a function pointer in that way. There's no way to do a computed go to. And this is all just in an attempt to be able to provide structured control flow so that you don't have to worry about programs executing things that they're not allowed to. So one of the ways that this is done is via like a special form of indirect call inside of WebAssembly. So here we have defined a couple of functions, and then we put those functions in a table, and then up here, we make a call indirect using that table in order to call one of these things. So essentially this is like in C, if you were to take a function pointer, having tables and call indirect is kind of the same sort of thing in WebAssembly. And if you were to use the WebAssembly compiler for like Clang, this is the kind of thing that would come out if you were using function pointers. So all of this, again, is just a way of saying, like, of providing control flow safety. So given that you can only call functions which the host environment has allowed, and have no way of referring to code locations as pointers, and by extension have no way of doing things like computed go-tos, control flow is a check. Likewise, given the fact that all memory dereferences inside of WebAssembly are bounds checked, all related faults are also bounds checked, we can then also say that data flow also applies to this. So essentially what I'm saying here is that if we had some way of compiling WebAssembly into a standard process, into a library that you could load into a process, we could actually provide isolation, right? Because we have those two things, control flow and data flow. So that gets us closer to our goal, which is being able to run many tenants in a single process in a single address space. Great, so if we can compile our code to WebAssembly, we can get the safety we need. And it turns out that Clang, Go, Rust, and others now have WebAssembly backends. We still need a way to be able to compile that WebAssembly to native code, right? You know, just WebAssembly having the semantics of this doesn't actually help us if we don't have a compiler. So the project that my team has been working on inside of Fastly has been working with Mozilla on this project called Kraton. So Kraton is a code generator specifically for WebAssembly and specifically meant to be able to generate isolatable code. We developed like a decent amount of code inside Kraton and on top of it, which ends up implementing basically the exact isolation scheme that I was just describing. There are a bunch of details that are interesting about this, but I believe I'm just about out of time, so we're actually going to skip the entire next section. I apologize. Oh man, but you were gonna get to see machine code, it was great. All right, review, isolation. Incredibly important to the way that we build programs today and do computation today at scale. Having a unified way of thinking about the effects of isolation or lack thereof seems even more important to me. Rather than thinking about the tool, say containers or jails or whatever, thinking about the guarantees that are offered by them and what your programs actually require seems like a useful thing. And finally, WebAssembly, super great. Thank you.